We'll proceed with the last case of the morning. Edonna Seymour v. Carol and Roger Hug. Ms. Metlaw.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Leslie Metlaw, and as appellant herein, I argue on my own behalf the denial...
Ms. Metlaw, I would appreciate your telling us why you have standing to challenge anything about this April 11, 2006 settlement order stipulating what's going to happen to the various attorneys' fees, since your name appears nowhere in the order, and how any other order entered in this case is properly before this Court.
Your Honor, although I am an unnamed party in interest to the agreement as set forth in the order of April 11th, 2006, a review of the order that was issued August 3rd, 2006 indicates clearly on no fewer than seven separate instances that I was a party to the settlement agreement.
But you're not in the order. I mean, John Marshall Law School gets some money that it's going to deliver to Willis Caruso. Donna Seymour gets some money. John Marshall Law School agrees to pay the defendants various stipulated things. You're asking us to delve way into this, to find you, and it seems to me if you have a dispute about a contractual arrangement you had with anybody else, whether it was your client, whether it was John Marshall, that's really up to you to pursue in some appropriate forum. It doesn't mean that it's all part of this case.
Your Honors, actual parties in interest have standing, with actual parties in interest being defined as people who participated in the settlement negotiations, have a direct economic stake in the outcome, and for whom injustice would be reaped.
Well, but you're assuming that we have no law of parties in the federal courts, and it's not always the case that an attorney whose fees are or are not, who knows from this settlement order since you're not here. So I could easily see if the John Marshall Law School wanted to complain about something, they're not a party to the underlying litigation, but they are, in fact, a party to this, or if Mr. Caruso, or if someone else. So I think you need to get beyond the formal law of parties.
May I be heard? Bill Caruso and the Fair Housing Legal Clinic of the John Marshall Law School was my co-counsel in this matter. We worked together in pursuit of plaintiff Donna Seymour's Fair Housing Act claim in the underlying litigation. And when the decision was rendered, going back to November of 2005, there were decisions, in those decisions, there was a finding that myself and my co-counsel, in addition to my client, had perpetrated a fraud upon the New York court and had defrauded the appellees here. Those orders otherwise would not be appealable but for the fact that in the order on my Rule 59 motion, which contested the final settlement order issued in April of 2006, wrapped into its terms the verbatim language from the settlement agreement that myself and my co-counsel entered into in order to settle the dispute as to whether or not we had made an error of law as to whether and fact as to whether or not apportionment was required under New York law in order to provide a full release to appellees of any potential claims of my client Donna Seymour's children in the underlying litigation. It was a matter of convenience for the parties that the remittance back of our earned attorney's fees and costs was to be funneled through the John Marshall Law School, as had been our practice in a number of cases. Bill Caruso and I have co-counseled on a number of fair housing cases.
Is that the $13,333 that they were supposedly getting out of this agreement?
That would have been the one-third of the $40,000 total settlement. That's correct, although there was an agreement between myself and my co-counsel, Bill Caruso, that there would be a split. My having participated in this case from the very beginning and brought it to John Marshall only when we were bringing it to federal court for litigation, that there would be a split of the fees relative to the amount of work that had been done. The 1333.
But again, that really sounds to me like a different lawsuit. I'm not saying that you don't have a right to pursue fees that you earned, but that is not part of this. You're referring to a different agreement. You're referring to something that, you know, the state courts hear such cases. Attorneys have disputes about how fees get allocated. I really can't see the link between that issue of yours and this settlement. And I also am actually quite concerned about efforts to bring forward the November settlement on the merits, where, as you say, I mean, certainly your name is implicated there, but whether a timely appeal has been filed from that by somebody with the right to take such an appeal is a whole different question.
Well, the my right to appeal and to question and object to the final settlement order was a product of what the language of that final settlement order contained. Had Magistrate Cole not brought in the settlement order into his final settlement order, I would not be here today. I did agree to, under a misapprehension, a uniform misapprehension among the parties and indeed of Magistrate Cole as to whether or not apportionment was required in order to release appellees under New York law. That was all the subject matter of the November orders. That had been resolved by our settlement agreement. And in fact, the real parties in interest, Donna Seymour, Ascendant Mobility, REMAX, and the sellers and realtors in interest, have all been redressed. Their case is over. This case is really about the settlement agreement, and I appear before you as a party to that settlement agreement, which, by virtue of the order that was issued in August of 2000, April of 2006, reached back into the underlying rationale for whether or not those fees were necessarily paid. There was a mistake of law and fact as to whether or not there was liability in New York. We all operated under a misapprehension, which did not become apparent until the materials from the New York State Court were issued in April, immediately prior to the final settlement order, but which were before the court prior to the issuance and entry of that final settlement order. And by virtue of Magistrate Cole's having imported in those terms with regard to the splitting and the remittance back of our earned fees, that called into question and rested upon the mistakes that were made in the November order, which
What do you expect to get out of this?
Well, I'm here for two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, while stigmatic injury to...
You didn't like what they said about you. That's unfortunate. What else?
Well, the correctness of... one moment, please. And just address myself to my specific answer that I have prepared. The Bolton Clark, which normally say that an attorney does not have standing, that 28 U.S.C. does not provide jurisdiction for an attorney to appeal mere stigmatic injury, is restricted to the mere stigmatic injury which may result from remarks made. I see that my red light is on.
Yeah, it is, and I know you've got to finish up, but this is, you know, this is sort of awkward here because you don't have standing to be here, and you obviously have a gripe. It looks to me like John Marshall paid the other side attorney's fees of $17,000. They got $13,000. Sounds to me like they're already in the hole. I don't know what you're expecting to get a share of. Maybe you want your reputation restored. I don't know what it is, but not here.
Well, Your Honor, well...
Well, just Ben, get, wrap it up because your time's run.
The correctness fell non of the November orders is the basis for our having entered into the side agreement surrendering my attorney's fees and litigation costs. Whether those orders were correct is central to the outcome of this appeal. And even if Your Honors decide that the November 2005 orders are not appealable, I respectfully request that this court take judicial notice of my arguments that the findings of those November orders were procedurally and substantively erroneous, and that their having undergirded the side agreement, which was wrapped into the April order, which was effectuated by that order, brings them within this court's purview with regard to the decision on my Rule 59 motion. I suffered not only stigmatic injury, which would otherwise not be appealable under Bolton Clark, but I suffered a monetary liability, which is the standard for appealability.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Donaldson.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, just a few things about jurisdiction to start with. In Ms. Matlaw's reply brief, she indicated that she was no longer appealing the April 14th, 2006 order, that this appeal now was strictly limited to the denial on August 10th of her Rule 59 motion. If that's the case, it's definitive. There is nothing left of this appeal before this court. The August 10th, 2006 denial of the motion that was filed in July of 2006 by Judge Cole was not specifically appealed from. There was not an amended notice of appeal as required by Appellate Rule 4A4B2. In addition, that was the second so-called Rule 59 motion. The first one, which is what gave this court jurisdiction to begin with, was based upon the Rule 72 objections that were presented to Judge Maravich in May of 2006. Those were filed within that 10-day time limit following the April 14th order. However, Judge Maravich denied those Rule 72 objections. So if, in fact, those Rule 72 objections can be converted legitimately into a Rule 59 motion, which the case law does probably support, that motion was ruled upon by Judge Maravich, and that motion was denied. There were several iterations of those Rule 72 objections. And at a certain point then in July of 2006, Ms. Matlaw started additional filings. While this appeal was pending, there were additional filings made in the district court with respect to relief from judgment that were actually presented to Judge Cole. Those were well beyond the 10 days of the April 14th order. At best, they would be considered a Rule 60 motion.
So would we have an appeal at least from a Rule 60 motion? Obviously, there's a certain standard of review for that, but we take appeals. Or is it your position that somehow, I think if I understand Ms. Matlaw's position, it's that these basic problems, as she sees it, with the earlier orders were encompassed within the notice of appeal that she did file, and so those at least become effective when the district judge finishes disposing of the case.
Sure, but by her own pleadings, she's conceded that she has no right to appeal the April 14, 2006 order. In her reply brief, she admits that that's not part of her appeal any longer, and Judge Maravich's denial of the Rule 72 objections are no longer part of her appeal. Those are the only two orders that the notice of appeal addressed. If we want to go back to the November 8th and November 9th, 2005 orders, we can certainly address those issues on the merits and go through what Ms. Matlaw is actually asking this court to do. She wants a finding that there's been this mutual misapprehension of fact and law. The fee agreement was reached because there was misconduct and there were misrepresentations made to the New York Surrogates Court, which were admitted to. There were misrepresentations made, and there was an admitted breach of the underlying settlement agreement. And that is why fees were reached. A fee agreement was not reached because everyone thought that these minors actually had valid claims. Ms. Matlaw's position that these minors never had any valid claims from day one, and she knew this, then why were the plaintiffs making a demand, a monetary demand of the defendants to settle these claims? We didn't care if the minors had valid claims or not. We wanted it all over with. The benefit of our bargain was any potential claims of the minors have been settled, and you will allocate a certain amount, whatever that might be. If it's zero, fine. We didn't even care. As long as there was a valid representation to the New York Surrogates Court that these minors might have potential claims, you look at it, you decide whether or not they should be released. To suggest that Judge Cole made a finding in November that the minors had valid claims is ridiculous. That Judge Cole wasn't asked to do that. He doesn't have the jurisdiction over the minors to decide whether or not they have any valid claims. They weren't parties to the litigation. Judge Cole's finding in November was, you agreed to this. Your client, as part of the settlement, agreed that she would allocate money to the children's claims. You made a demand for them. And rather than go forward with that, Ms. Seymour, about 2 weeks after the settlement was reached, decided she didn't want any money to go to her children. And so rather than convey to the defendants this change in heart, because that would have terminated the deal. There would no longer have been a settlement. We wanted this litigation to end. Rather than tell us that Ms. Seymour no longer wanted to allocate money to the children, Ms. Seymour and her counsel changed and fudged the terms of the settlement agreement and the release. They fudged the petitions that they presented to the New York Surrogates Court, saying that a claim had never been made for the children, saying that the children's claims were not part of the settlement, it was only Ms. Seymour's settlement, tried to hide those petitions from the defendants. And then when the defendants found out and would not pay the money and asked Ms. Seymour and her counsel to go back to the Surrogates Court, they refused. And so the issue was litigated by Judge Cole as to what exactly the terms of the settlement were. There was no mistake that these children really had valid claims. To say so now is a complete fiction. And to go so far as to say that the orders entered eventually in the New York Surrogates Court when the proper petitions were eventually filed, to say that the New York Surrogates Court found or held that these children did not have minor claims is also a complete fiction. The New York Surrogates Court was asked to make a determination as to whether or not a $1,000 allocation was fair and reasonable, and it said, yes, it is. The New York Surrogates Court was not asked to make any finding and did not make any finding. And to somehow suggest that those rulings made in April somehow converted everything that was done in November to this mutual mistake of law or fact is complete and utter fiction. It's rewriting the facts of this case and manipulating. There have been so many iterations of so many different documents. We can't get a final position on anything in this case.
Well, let me just stop you there, because I think for this court, the most important question, of course, is whether we have appellate jurisdiction over something. The next question is whether the party appearing before the court has proper standing to bring the particular claim that she's bringing. We might be a ways from looking at any underlying merits. Of course, at the end of the day, if we answer the questions about jurisdiction and standing, positively for the appealing party, then we would move on to these merits.
I think one thing, again, Ms. Mantla has, I believe, conceded in her reply brief that the only thing she's appealing is the denial of the Rule 59 motion, the August
10th. Which is the one that relates to the Rule 72, so perhaps mislabeled, objections to what Judge Maravich did.
Correct. And because this is something that she addressed in her reply for the first time, it was not addressed, obviously, in our response brief. But so basically, Ms. Mantla then is using the Rule 59, Rule 60 motion to bootstrap an appeal on something that she had no right to appeal from in the beginning. And that's not appropriate or proper. She's trying to create issues in the Rule 59 motion that don't emanate from the April 2006 order, which is what started this appeal to begin with.
Who were the plaintiffs in the original action, the fair housing?
There was only one plaintiff. It was Donna Seymour, the mother. She was the only claimant in the Fair Housing Act case, as well as in the litigation in the district court. There were allegations in the complaint made with respect to the children. There were allegations made in deposition testimony with respect to the damages to the children. And there was a demand made of $50,000 as to each child during the litigation.
So the only way the children came in was through the settlement agreement?
Correct. The defendants would ask that this court affirm the rulings of the district court and then an end to this litigation be had.
Okay, thanks. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement. That completes the arguments for the morning, now afternoon. The court will be in recess. We'll meet tomorrow morning.